we have a very packed agenda. So, Winter, would you please, I'm going to call the meeting to order, and would you please take roll?
Chair McAdoo? Vice Chair Trachok?
Here.
Regent Carter?
Here.
Regent Lieberman?
Here.
Regent Perkins?
Here.
You have a quorum present.
Thank you. I want to make note that item number 11 has been pulled from today's agenda and will come back at a later date. And is there any public comment? I see no public comment, so we will move on to agenda item number 2 for the consent items.
Move for approval.
Right, I have a motion for approval. Do I have a second?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Is there any discussion on the consent items? All right, no discussion. All those in favor say aye.
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 So any opposition? I vote aye as well. Consent items pass. Moving to item number 3, if Renee Davis is at the podium. Thank you.
Hello, Renee Davis, Assistant Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs, Nevada System of Higher Education. I'm here to bring forward an update asked, requested by the Council of Presidents to the planning report. They asked for more frequent opportunities to update the planning report, in particular regarding the degrees and programs they want to bring forward. So the report was in your materials, and if you have any questions, I would defer to the institutions.
Are there any questions from the committee? No? No questions? All right. I would entertain a motion. It's been moved. Do I have a second?
Second.
All right. Moved and seconded. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? I vote aye as well. The motion passes. Thank you. Thank you, Renee. Item number 4, GBC. A program proposal for manufacturing machine technology. And Dr. Sonia Brown, Vice President of Academic Affairs at GBC, will present. Oh, you need your mic on. Thank you.
Thank you. Is that better? Wonderful. Thank you for the introduction, Kathy. So GBC is bringing forward the proposal for the Manufacturing Machining Technology Associates Program in order to expand our technical program offerings down at the Pahrump Valley Center. The Pahrump Valley Center currently has no technical programs, and we've established workforce demand and student interest specifically for manufacturing machining technology.
Are there any questions from the committee? All right. I would entertain a motion.
So moved.
All right. It's been moved and a second. All right. Any questions, discussion?
Aye.
Thank you.
All right. Agenda item number 5, Provost Carmen from UNR.
Thank you, Regent McAdoo. Kevin Carmen, UNR. Provost and Executive Vice President, for the record, we bring to you today for your consideration a proposal for a Bachelor of Fine Arts in Graphic Design. This will be a professional degree that emphasizes hands-on design approaches in the context of critical analysis, theory, research, and application. Graduates will be highly competent in graphic design professional skills and will be well prepared for career placement. The program is designed to meet the National Association of Schools of Art and Design, NASAD, accreditation, which we plan to be pursuing in the near future. It will include a variety of field-related coursework, and students will graduate with a portfolio of professional quality projects that will facilitate their transition into their careers. The curriculum will focus on web interface design, 3D modeling and animation, package design, and environmental graphic design, as well as typeface design. And the program will produce opportunities for collaboration with other academic programs at UNR, such as business, journalism, and engineering. We've seen a lot of enthusiasm from the local business community with all the technology firms moving to town. We think that there are tremendous career opportunities for students in this degree. So with that, I'd be happy to answer questions if you have any.
Okay. Any questions? Regent Carter.
So when I was looking through, I didn't see any reference to the Nevada State College program mentioned, but also the TMCC Nevada State College graphics program that's going to be launching very soon up there, and how that complements or competes with UNR's proposed program.
Thank you. We do have articulation agreements with all of the community college and their graphic arts programs, including TMCC. I'd welcome TMCC to comment specifically if they would care to. But we do have articulation agreements. But the BFA is a different degree than the simple graphic design. It's a more advanced degree. I also do have the director of the School of the Arts, Tamara Schrantz, here if you want some more specific details from her.
I guess my particular concern was that it just wasn't mentioned at all in the proposal, so I didn't know if you guys didn't know about the program or what the reasoning behind not having it in the proposal at all was.
Well, I guess that was an oversight on our part, for which I apologize. We certainly are aware of the program, and we've been in discussion with TMCC.
Any other questions or comments? No. Nope. I will entertain a motion.
Move to approve.
Second. Do I have a second? Regent Perkins, thank you. All right, any questions? All right, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Well, the motion passes. Thank you. And Provost Carmen, I believe you're doing the Doctor of Musical Arts.
Yes, again, thank you, Regent McAdoo, Kevin Carmen, for the record, Executive Vice President and Provost at UNR. We bring to you for your consideration a proposal for a Doctorate of Musical Arts. This will be a program of study at the highest level of music that prepares students for the highest types of positions, professional positions such as university faculty, leaders of distinguished orchestras, choirs, and bands. This is a degree program that has been in the works for some time. Back in 2014, we funded a cluster proposal, a group of faculty hires, to build this Doctor of Musical Arts program, and it is now coming to its fruition after several years of planning and preparation. We will offer three tracks focusing on performances, on performance, including strings, voice, and instrumental, and three in conducting, including choral, orchestral, and wind. DMA will bring national attention to our music program and will help us recruit top faculty and students. I'd also like to note that the DMA program will also have a transformational impact on our undergraduate and master's program students, as it will provide the opportunity for less experienced students to interact and collaborate with advanced students in the Doctor of Musical Arts program. We anticipate that this will create a virtuous cycle of quality and quantity in our music program as we attract and retain top talent. Our proposed Doctor of Musical Arts program is unique in that it provides students an opportunity to gain education in auxiliary fields such as business, communication studies, counseling and educational psychology, and entrepreneurship. Finally, I'd like to note that this degree program will ensure that we are gaining the greatest return on our investment in our new state-of-the-art arts facility that includes extraordinary performance, practice, and recording facilities for our music students and faculty. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Move to approve.
All right. Second. Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
I vote aye as well. The motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I want to thank the institutions for bringing these proposals. And I'm always excited when we have new degree programs to support student needs within the state of Nevada. Thank you. All right. Agenda item number 7. Metro Momentum, and I think Associate Vice President of Academic Affairs James McCoy from College of Southern Nevada will be presenting. Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. James McCoy, Associate Vice President for the College of Southern Nevada Academic Affairs. For the record, I'm joined by Dr. Laurel Pritchard and Dr. Tony Shinta from UNLV and Nevada State College. accordingly. The last time we saw each other, we had an opportunity in this committee to talk about the Metro Momentum Pathways work as sponsored by Complete College America. As you recall, Southern Nevada INSHE institutions were sort of recognized as a metro hub with over 100,000 credit and non-credit students where this project for these students would be beneficial. You also recall in our last conversation that the work around the Metro Momentum Pathways project is directly aligned with the board's mission and the board's strategic goals, and so it couldn't have come at a better time. I want to provide just a couple of minutes, and I mean just a couple, of brief context to transition us to the data. At our last conversation, there was a request to see some of the benchmark data that we are holding ourselves accountable to for entering into this project. Just as a reminder, the board and this particular committee have heard from leaders from around the country during student success special board meetings and closing the achievement gap special board meetings from representatives from Complete College America. So I know you're all too familiar with this framework, so I'll be brief in this moment. But as you recall, the Metro Momentum Pathways work is twofold. One, there's a tremendous focus on student success initiatives with really taking a data-focused approach, which I know is important to all of us. Some of the initiatives that this focuses around is around the sort of the credit momentum approach from credit accumulation. The idea is around 15 to finish or finish in two. The momentum year around how we onboard our students, how we give them that college experience from day one of application and work to support our students throughout their experience on our campuses. Not the least of which is through academic maps and guided pathways and very much proactive academic advising. On the fact, everyone's okay? We're good. Sorry. On the faculty side, there's a lot of curricular conversation happening around co-requisite math remediation and co-requisite English remediation. And so there's lots of conversations dovetailing the curricular work within this project as well. The second major component, the metro piece of the Momentum Pathways work, is centered around helping our students overcome some of their, as some would refer to, non-academic barriers. These are areas that in decades past we used to think we'd not could not affect, things like food insecurity or homelessness or childcare challenges. These are things that are woven into each of our three institutions' Metro Momentum Pathways plans with viable solutions relying on philanthropic support and community nonprofit support in our region in the South. As you recall, this has been a very phased approach with lots of conversation throughout our region. We launched this with an in-state leadership meeting in November of last fall. We followed that up by pulling together teams from across UNLV, Nevada State College, and the College of Southern Nevada through an action summit where we acquainted these teams with these strategies and charged the teams with beginning to think about how they might begin to put a plan onto paper in response, perhaps, to the student success plans that were shared with the board just a couple of months earlier. And since we've met, all of our institutions have gathered as a large team through a Complete College America-sponsored planning academy. And this was a two-day intense academy where content experts from across the country gathered in Southern Nevada with us to talk through some of the implementation challenges and obstacles that might get in our way so that we can be better prepared to address them, and also to really help us focus into the data that is what you'll be seeing in just a moment today. Just after our planning academy, our institutional research leaders from across the three institutions in Southern Nevada got together to develop a set of metrics and to ensure that the data that we're looking at from a benchmark standpoint are indeed the same sort of data, right? We're therefore comparing apples to apples and oranges to oranges. And it was also important to note how far back we needed to go to establish such a baseline. And so you'll see that baseline data in today's conversation and moving forward as we continue to report that we will go back 5 years. I shared briefly in our last conversation that there were several leading indicators that we would be monitoring on a semester-by-semester basis. I won't read them, but they are here in your reference material for you. Given the time frame that we've got today, we have selected some particular metrics to share with you from a benchmark standpoint. They all come from the previous leading indicator metric slide I just shared with you. And so today we're prepared from a College of Southern Nevada, Nevada State College, and UNLV standpoint to each share with you our benchmark data for our institutions for this project. I want you to know that all of this data is disaggregated by ethnicity, by gender, by student socioeconomic status as determined by things like Pell, and on age. And it's all disaggregated, of course, by institution as well, UNLV, Nevada State, and CSN. So with that, each of our institutions have about 8 data slides to share with you. It'll go pretty quick because the template is just about identical for all of us, so you'll be able to see some similarities here in terms of the presentation of the data. It's important to note, as you look at these data slides, at the very bottom of each slide, the cohort is reinforced, the N number, the sample, the population is noted as well, both in terms of the actual N and of course, the percentages as well. And most of this is most of this data is represented in a cohort, first time in college, credential seeking students, it's degree or certificate seeking, full or part time, and this is of course all pooled and identified through the IPEDS fall enrollment surveys across our institutions. So this first leading indicator for this benchmark data is persistence, first term to second term, first fall to spring, right? And as we go back again 5 years, you're looking at fall 2013 and kind of progressing along the trend to fall of 2017. This is CSN data here first. So you'll notice from in fall of 2013, we had a fall to spring persistence rate of 69.5% of this cohort. It's trending upwards, as you can see now in the last reported year of 2017, we're at 76.3, but we're not done yet. But that 76.3 serves as the benchmark by which we will continue to measure. And so as we move another year into this work and we pull the 2018 data, the 13 data will fall, the 18 data will replace it.
How does that compare to other colleges within our system and with other comparable colleges across the country, just focusing on the first term to second term persistence?
Thank you, Regent Trachok. That's a great question. You'll see the comparison, at least in terms of UNLV and Nevada State College here this morning in just a moment. In terms of our peer institutions, I'd have to pull that. We're trending just a little bit lower than the national peer average for our size of an institution at CSN. But if you'd like, we could follow up with that direct peer-to-peer institution for community colleges like CSN. And within our system across all of our institutions? Okay, noted. Thank you. This next metric is persistence now, but not from a term-to-term standpoint, but from a first year or first fall to a second fall perspective. Again, the same cohort, first time in college, credential seeking, part-time or full-time. And we're looking to the students that persist to the next year. They must re-enroll at CSN or obtain an award. And in this case, within that year, it's oftentimes that short-term certificate. So you can see in this data that from the fall 13 to the fall 17, that indeed the trend line is moving in the right direction for the most part. I can say pretty closely, Regent Trachok, particularly related to your question on this particular data set, the national average for community colleges from our peer institutions for community colleges is about a 60% fall to fall for this particular cohort. So CSN is slightly below the national and the peers on the persistence.
And if I might follow up on that, what percentage of we're comparing the semester to semester persistence, and then you mentioned that you have some students who are getting the certificate that they are seeking within their first year, and so are they then obviously they're not included within this study here, but what percentage of the total students constitutes those that are getting their certificate within their first year or their career objectives, educational objectives in the first year? So we make sure we understand why you have this 20% drop.
Yep, great question. I don't have that data in front of me today, but I will certainly make sure that's prepared. That become part of our disaggregation moving forward. Thank you, Regent Trachok. Moving on to the next metric, this is particularly centered around the 15 to finish or finish in two campaign that this board has adopted statewide. This is one of those leading indicators for momentum, for building momentum to graduation or completion. Again, first time in college, credential seeking students, to have momentum in their first fall, student must have completed 15 or more credits at least a grade of D minus or better, including those satisfactory and pass grades. This is consistent sort of notes for each of the institutions that you'll hear from today. So you'll see in fall of 2013, the percentage of this cohort that accumulated and earned at least 15 credits in their first fall was 2.4%. It's about doubled in fall 17. But this is sort of coming up against a landscape of part-time to full-time student populations. And so when this data becomes disaggregated, it'll be very interesting to take a look at what the percentage of the part-time students are represented versus the full-time students. Obviously, with earning 15 credits in the first fall, that student would have had to have been enrolled in at least 15 credits. We've got some significant work to do here. This is a major leading indicator from the Complete College America lens on student completion, degree or certificate. And this is the ability to accumulate 30 or more credits in an entire year. And so this particular data is, again, the same cohort looking at the first year completing 30 credits at a grade of D minus or better. And you can see those trend lines are, again, moving in the right direction. But again, we're not done yet. But this becomes, again, the benchmark data for us to measure the implementation of our student success plans moving forward. For CSN, the average credits attempted in the first fall, this is what they enrolled in, what they attempted to engage in, regardless of the grade that they received. And you'll see fall 13, 8.5 credits is what this cohort on average were enrolling in their first fall. That's now up to 10.1. So our benchmark for this particular work is 10.1. This is really a metric around our Finish in 2 communication campaign. This is a metric around our Guided Pathways Academic Maps campaign and around our Proactive Advising campaign. This next one is the average credits completed in the first fall. So previously we saw attempted, now we see completed, 6.3 in fall 13, 7.7 in fall of 2017. So again, it's moving in the right direction. That fall 17 becomes the benchmark for us to measure against our student success plans. Now, from a first semester, we're going to a first year. This is average credits attempted in the first year, same cohort. And I want to note here that this first year, as defined by CC Complete College America, is if they engaged in the summer before their first fall, that enrollment is counted as part of their first year. Then it moves into their first fall, first spring, and then the summer following their first spring. So you see a 16.3 credit average accumulation, or attempt, I should say, and then a 20.1 into fall 17. Again, we're seeing some trend in the right direction here, but if you pay close attention to that fall 2017 number, again, that is the benchmark that we are all trying to target to double down and increase. This is average credits completed in the first year. Previous slide was attempted. Same cohort, same perspective in terms of the data and the notes. 12 in fall 13, 15.4 in fall of 17. So now I'm going to hand over the control to Dr. Tony Shinta from Nevada State College, going through the same metrics for Nevada State College.
Okay, thank you. For the record, Tony Shinta, Executive Vice Provost at Nevada State College. And in looking at the Nevada State College data, there's a pretty clear theme, which is that we were on an upward trajectory with a lot of these metrics, which I think is due in large part to Complete College America initiatives we had taken on before we even got into this particular project. And then in 2017, we took a hit and a lot of those numbers declined. And it's almost, you know, we had a tremendous amount of growth and we had a challenge in keeping up with the degree of growth we had in that particular year. But it's kind of like a boxer. We got hit with a good punch, we took a knee, and then we got back up and we took what we learned and applied it to this year. And so I will provide you with some numbers that aren't on these slides that show what is already developing this year and our return to a positive trajectory. So in that sense, if you look at persistence, for the most part, these numbers speak for themselves. What you can see here both is the persistence rates from first term to second term. We also see the size of the class and that tremendous jump in enrollment you can see here with that bar and the height of that bar in fall 2017. We went from 325 to 554. And again, you see a little bit of a decrease in the persistence for that year. It's more noticeable when you look at persistence first year to second year. Again, generally an upward trajectory from 57.4% to 69.8%. But then we dipped for the fall 17 year. Now, what I could tell you is, for the previous slide, we're already at 85%. For this year, for the fall 18 cohort, we're already at a persistence of 67%, and we still will enroll a lot of our students for the fall over the summer, because that's just the way it works. So we expect to be very well back onto a positive trajectory relative to the dip you can see in this slide right here. Earned credits, 15 or more, by first fall. Again, you see a pretty powerful upward trajectory from 13.7%, which is around the time we started thinking about 15 to finish, to 34.8% in fall 16. Again, the drop to 26.5% in fall 17. For the fall 18 cohort, we're already at 38% for these numbers. You can see we've rebounded to our highest mark ever based on what we learned from our experiences with that huge fall 17 class and the fact that we did have a smaller class in that year. Moving forward, same pattern, earned credits in a year, upward trajectory, and then a dip in 17. For average credits attempted, you see that's increasing as well. What's interesting here is the average credits attempted, it has gone up over time. And that's gone up even as our class sizes have increased in size. Average credits completed also has gone up, okay? But this is the part that I think is telling, but it's lower than what is attempted. So they're completing lower than what's attempted. And I think it's partly what we and Complete College America have learned is that for some students, 15 credits in a semester isn't necessarily the most advisable pathway, but 30 credits in a year is still a very strong predictor of success. So we're still a big proponent of 15 to finish, but at the same time, for certain students, we're trying to tailor that effort to get them more credits accumulated across a year, because they can do that with all their other life obligations more successfully than they can do 15 credits in a semester, and that you still get the same positive outcome for those students. And here are the credits attempted in the first year. Again, the same pattern, the same effort, striving towards getting at least 30 credits. And here's the average credits completed, again, underlining that point that it's below what they're attempting, and we're trying to find that spot where there's great credit accumulation, and yet the students are still successful in what they're trying to do. Okay, and that's it. And now I'm going to hand it over to Dr. Laurel Pritchard at UNLV.
We have a question.
I have a question.
Oh, sorry.
Same question that I asked CSN. How does this compare to the what you would consider your peer institutions?
In terms of first-year persistence, we actually look pretty good. Our challenge is in maintaining the success rates across second, third, fourth, fifth year. A quick representative example, Southern Utah University was giving a presentation at a conference I was at, and their graduation rate is somewhere 45-46%, and yet their first year retention was 68%. Our first year retention for IPEDS has generally gotten it to above 70%, and yet we're not enjoying graduation rates at that level. And we have a very high transfer out rate. That's part of it. We're a small institution. Sometimes we don't have the degree that students want, but a lot of our efforts are in going beyond what's happening in the first year, which you see a lot of here. It's important. The momentum is important, but it's a matter of continuing that momentum into the subsequent years. So we look good with these numbers, but we need to get better with what happens after the first year.
And what does the data tell you?
What do these data tell us?
What does it tell you that we need to be doing at Nevada State?
One of the foremost things is we got to provide really good, predictable degree pathways for students. You know, as a small institution, it's already endemic to a small institution that you can't put up a section for every time of day, day of the week, and every modality. And yet, that's one of the biggest challenges our students face. We see it in the data in terms of what they're able to complete, and we also see it in what they tell us that you don't see here, where one of the foremost challenges is, I can't get the class I need when I need it. And so I think these data suggest to us that beyond the first year, which is very structured and we have some success, we need more structure going through the entire degree pathway for students, more predictability, and essentially more classes that they know they can take in order to graduate in a timely fashion. But the last thing I will say, because this is kind of interesting, we've done it very recently, we started doing some machine learning analyses, just a new kind of statistic, and they really do suggest, like you just kind of, it's like a, a food processor, you dump all kinds of variables in there and you see what predicts success the most. And students earning at least 27 credits in their first year was highly predictive of graduation rates, and that was even when you control for high school GPA. So it's a matter of building on that momentum and making sure that they have that pathway to graduation.
How big of a problem is not offering the classes that at the times required by our students? How big of a problem is that for our students?
I mean, for us, it definitely is a pretty significant challenge. You know, we get good marks for our teaching. You know, the students aren't leaving because they say the teachers aren't good enough or the classes aren't good enough. We get good marks for a lot of aspects of the college, but we struggle as a small institution in paving those pathways in certain areas. So I think it's a huge deal, but the silver lining is I think if we fix that and we work on that issue, I think it'll pay tremendous dividends. Then it'll boil down more to a matter of not that I didn't have a great degree pathway, but some students will leave just because we're small and we don't have the degree they ultimately wanted to pursue.
Regent Trachok, I just also wanted to add, just to get very specific about that, you can be very efficient in a model so that you don't offer courses with low enrollment, but what we're talking about at the college as we get financially a little stronger is we're going to need to offer more classes with lower enrollment, which is not as efficient for us from an economic standpoint in order to get more students graduated, to make sure that we're offering classes every semester, probably morning and night, so that it meets better with what students need and their schedules, given that they work and have other family obligations. So we're looking at changing what we're doing internally now as we get in a little better position to be able to afford it, so to speak.
Good morning. For the record, Laurel Pritchard, Vice Provost for Undergraduate Education at UNLV. So I won't belabor the data definitions since you've already heard those for the other institutions. We'll start with persistence from the first to the second term. As you can see at UNLV, we've had a fairly high and stable persistence from first to second term over the past 5 years, hovering right around 90%. When we look at how that plays out from the first year to the second year, again, you can see that that metric has been very stable over time, right around 75%. What you can't see on this slide, because the data only go up to fall 2017, is that we have had some recent gains in our first to second year persistence. We expect to see those continue. And that's an area that we're really focused on. If you were able to attend the January NSHE Student Success Summit, you heard our president, Marta Miena, talk about some significant investments that we are making in support for first-year students, particularly in the areas of proactive advising and peer mentoring that we hope will allow our first- to second-year persistence numbers to move in a positive direction. Now turning our attention to credit accumulation, specifically earning 15 or more credits in the first fall term, you can see that we've made significant progress on this metric over the past 5 years, starting at 36.2% of our students accumulating 15 or more credits in the first term in fall 2013, to 56.4% in fall 2017. And we believe this is attributable largely to our implementation of Complete College America's 15 to Finish campaign in fall 2014. And the specific strategies that we've used with 15 to Finish are automatic administrative enrollment of all first-time freshmen in 15 credits for their first term as part of new student orientation. We've also added a discussion about 15 to Finish and the importance of credit accumulation to our advising checklist, so every student hears about this when they have an advising appointment. when we look at how that plays out over the course of the first year, we see that we've gone from 32.3% of our students completing 30 credits or more in the first year in 2013 to 47.8% in fall of 2017. So we've also seen significant progress on accumulation across the first year, though, as you'll notice, the percentage of students who are able to accumulate 30 credits is lower than those who accumulate 15 in the first term. This suggests that we really need to focus on keeping up the 15 to finish messaging in the second term. In terms of credits attempted in the first fall term, again, this metric has been fairly stable over time, but we have seen a little bit over half a credit increase from 2013 to 2017. So on average, our students are taking almost 15 credits in that first term. When we look at the number of those credits that are successfully completed by students in the first term with a passing grade, on average, they are passing 12.6 of those 14 and a half credits that they're attempting. And then when we look at how that plays out over the first year, again, very stable over time, but with a slight increase, a little over a credit over 5 years. On average, our students are attempting 27.3 credits across the entire first year. And they're successfully completing 25 out of those 27.3 credits in the first year. And one thing that we've been very mindful of and intentional about at UNLV is understanding that not all credits factor into this average equally, meaning that there are courses that have significantly lower pass rates than other courses. So we have tracked those courses. We've been very intentional about disseminating the pass rate data to the departments that offer these courses and have worked with them in some cases to redesign the instructional methods for those classes. So some notable examples include our first year math courses and our Communication Studies 101 course. And you don't see it here because those changes have happened more recently than these data reflect. But as this project continues, I believe that you'll see significant increases in this average due to those course redesigns.
I have a question. What do you mean course redesign? We're not dumbing the courses down so we have a higher percent passing, are we?
Absolutely not. When I say course redesign, I mean an intentional process of examining how the course is structured and the pedagogical methods that the instructors use to ensure that every student in the course has an opportunity to learn the course content and successfully demonstrate their knowledge. So some examples of the ways the courses have changed. In our math courses, our new department chair, Dr. ZJ Wu, has created a faculty learning community. Each course has a coordinator. Those coordinators meet with the chair weekly. They discuss particular topics from that week that students struggled with and how they're going to go back and address those topics to make sure that students are able to master them before they move on. In communication studies, one example of how the course has been changed is that it now includes a multimedia lab component. We know that the standard public speaking, standing up in front of a room of people, is not necessarily what our students need or want to learn. And so we've modernized the content of that course. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Are there any additional questions for any of our presenters? No. Thank you very much. Appreciate your presentation. And it was an information-only item. We will move on to item number 8.
Madam Chair, with your permission, as the presenters approach the podium, I'll just remind the committee of the history on this item. You'll recall that the board had a student success summit in January of this year. We followed up with a full board discussion with a what the chancellor referred to as a matrix of strategies to support students. And from that, it was actually a request via the full board, Regent Hayes, who unfortunately is not here today. But I wanted to note that for the record so that I can request an audio of this and make sure that he is able to hear the full presentation, because this is an issue that he specifically requested.
Thank you. And I just, in the essence of time, I want to remind us this agenda item has 20 minutes, and we have 7 institutions presenting. So if I could ask that you go in order and the second presenter be lined up to go and just do that. It will save time for all the effort that you've put into your presentation. So I'm going to give you that order really quickly. University of Nevada, Reno, University of Nevada, Las Vegas, Great Basin College, Truckee Meadows Community College, Western Nevada College, CSN, NSC. If I can get UNLV sure. to get in line back there, so you're ready to go. Thank you.
And Chair McAdoo, I'm Juanita Crisanto, VP for Student Affairs at CSN for the record. And I will be presenting for all of the institutions in the interest of time. So that's hopefully that will work.
I just gave that speech for no reason. Thank you so much.
I would never interrupt the chair.
So. Well, you should have. Thank you.
You're welcome. Good morning, members of the board, ARSA committee, and colleagues. I just stated my name for the record, Juanita Crisanto, and I will be presenting on behalf of the Student Affairs Council. My colleagues are all present to answer any questions that you may have on this important topic of services provided to part-time students, a group that represents more than 40,000 students within the NC system. We collectively want to express our appreciation to the board for your keen focus on student success. And as Chair Page has previously said, it is the only way our entire state can move forward and meet the needs of our growing economy. During this presentation, I will introduce each institution through a brief profile review of part-time students and then highlight success initiatives that are both ongoing and upcoming at our institutions. It's important to note that for this presentation, we will focus on undergraduate students only, and those are students who are enrolled in less than 12 credit hours in a semester. These students are by definition omitted from the IPEDS graduation rate survey if they are not first-time, full-time degree-seeking students. Although it's important to note that students who start full-time may end up being part-time students, and students who start part-time may end up becoming full-time students. Let's begin with University of Nevada, Reno. And the information was provided by my colleague, VP Shannon Ellis. As you can see, at UNR, part-time students over the past 3 fall semesters have accounted for approximately 13% of the overall undergraduate population. There are typically more female part-time students at UNR, but the ratio has been nearly 50-50 over the course of the past 3 fall semesters. The ethnicity breakdown of part-time students has also remained fairly consistent over the past 3 years, with white students making up the majority of part-time students, approximately 57%, followed by Hispanic students at 23%, followed by Asian students at approximately 7%. Over the past 3 years, the predominant age range for students who enroll part-time has been 21 to 24 years old, representing approximately 45% of part-time students. These students are most often seniors only taking courses that are required to graduate. At UNR, part-time students have access to the same programs and services that full-time students do. Some of the areas that are most beneficial to the part-time students include academic advising,
financial aid, counseling services, health services, and the others that you see listed on the screen. Part-time students are encouraged to enroll in the student experience in the same manner as full-time students. Next up, University of Nevada, UNLV. Okay. At UNLV, part-time students enrollment has been approximately 25% of the undergraduate enrollment for the past three semesters. Like UNR, the students are typically more female who enroll part-time than the male students. The gap at UNLV is slightly larger, with an average of 54% of the part-time students being female. Among full-time students, 57% are female. Over the past 3 years at UNLV, the number of Hispanic students attending part-time has increased, while the number of white students attending part-time has decreased. At present, each group represents 31% of the part-time student population. Among full-time students, the ratios for all ethnic groups are similar to part-time students, and the patterns of change are also similar. The age range of part-time students has remained mostly consistent over 3 years at UNLV, with students ranging in age from 21 to 24, making up between 37 to 40% of part-time students. Full-time students are much more likely to be under the age of 20, and it is the largest category of full-time students, with 18 years old being the most common age among full-time students. Like UNR, part-time students enrolled in UNLV are afforded the same programs and services as full-time students. However, there are a few programs in place to help understand and meet the needs of part-time students at UNLV. One such program is the Adult Learner Advisory Board, which collaborates with campus partners to recognize non-traditional students and provide meaningful connections, services, and opportunities that will assist those students in obtaining personal and academic success at UNLV. A second example is the Rebel Scholars Program. This program encourages non-traditional learners to participate in opportunities outside the classroom, such as attending career fairs, participating in UNLV-sponsored community service events, and attending academic success workshops. Students who complete a series of these benchmark tasks and maintain certain other requirements are awarded a special cord at graduation. Now to Great Basin College, for which VP Jake Rivera provided us the information. GBC's enrollment of part-time students is typically between 73 to 75% total enrollment. The ethnicity breakdown of part-time students closely matches the full-time student profile, with white students making up approximately 60% of both full-time and part-time students, and Hispanic Latino students making up approximately 21% of full-time and part-time students. At GBC, students who are under 18 make up the largest percentage of part-time students, typically between 30 to 34%. GBC offers several services to part-time students, many of which have an online component to provide the flexibility that part-time students often require. For example, the Cranium Cafe is a video chat teleconferencing platform that allows advisors to meet with students online rather than requiring them to come in person. GBC also offers 8-week condensed classes with various start dates to better accommodate part-time students and offers walk-in times for students on Saturdays in the 2 weeks leading up to the start of the semester. GBC has several initiatives forthcoming and will continue to identify best practices that meet the needs of part-time students. For example, GBC will begin using Starfish as a platform to alert students who are falling behind academically. GBC is also reviewing hours for key service areas to better accommodate students who are not able to be on campus. This also includes exploring the option of Friday-only courses. Truckee Meadows Community College information was provided by VP Estella Lavario Gutierrez. Over the past 3 years, TMCC has had between 71 and 72% of their students enrolling part-time. The majority of part-time students are white, with 55% in the fall of 2018, and Hispanic, 30% in the fall of 2018. Like GBC, TMCC is beginning to offer more services online, on weekends, and in the evening. TMCC has been engaging with students to encourage registration and continued persistence, while also dedicating a specific phone number and office space to meet with students who are part-time students at TMCC. The college is also offering Getting Ahead workshops for non-traditional students and part-time faculty mentors. At present, TMCC has a campaign each semester to encourage part-time students to take additional classes. This includes contacting students receiving the SSOG Silver State Opportunity Grant and Promise Scholars and encouraging increased credit hour enrollment. When part-time students don't return to TMCC, they are asked to complete a survey to help better understand the reasons for their enrollment lapse. Moving forward, TMCC has plans to continue supporting part-time students, including plans to hire a concierge and full-time academic advisor dedicated to serving part-time students. There is also consideration to expand more services beyond Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, to offer evening and weekend services to students. There's also work being done on the research, implementation, and maintenance of a TMCC life map system to help students complete their career and educational goals, and consideration is being given to an online platform to help faculty members conduct office hours in a virtual setting. Western Nevada College, information provided by Dean Diane Hilliard, here we go. Of the 3,327 students enrolled at WNC in the fall of 2018, 64% attended part-time. In the fall of 2018, 52% of part-time students were over 25 years of age, and 57% of part-time students were women. White students consistently make up the majority of part-time student enrollment, with Hispanic students being the next highest represented ethnic group. WNC implemented Project Graduate, a program which requires students to go through one-on-one advisement before registering for classes. They also have made changes to increase the availability of short-term classes year-round and provide more flexible options to students, such as when classes are offered, where they're offered, and the modality through which they are offered. WNC is now considering various strategies to address the challenges of part-time students. A few of these strategies include introducing a first-year experience, introducing new technology that will enable academic advising to occur remotely, implementing Starfish for retention efforts, providing students with faculty and staff advisement and monitor and mentoring, and providing students with linked courses. College of Southern Nevada. CSN has been fairly consistent over the past 3 years with part-time student enrollment. 71% of students in both fall of 2016 and 2017 were enrolled part-time, and 67% of students were part-time in the fall of 2018. The gender ratio is consistent over the past 3 years, with each year male students at 40% of the part-time student population and female students representing 60% of the part-time student population. The ethnicity of part-time students at CSN has remained fairly consistent over the past 3 years, with Hispanic and white students being the two largest groups. In the fall of 2018, Hispanic students were 34% and white students were at 28% of part-time attendees. Over the past 3 years, at CSN, approximately 38% of part-time students and 26 years and older, and 62% of part-time students are 25 or younger. This summer, CSN will be scaling up our First Steps process, requiring all first-time and college students to complete testing, orientation, either online or in person, and academic advising. Mandatory academic advising will continue for all students as they earn 5, 15, 30, and 45 credit hours, respectively. CSN has made great strides in encouraging the completion of Gateway Math and English courses through intentional academic advising. This will continue and improve as CSN looks to hire additional academic advisors and begins to lower the advisor-to-student ratio. Finally, but not least, of course, Nevada State College. Information provided by Executive Vice Provost Tony Shinta. Looking at the total undergraduate enrollment at Nevada State, the headcount of part-time students has increased by 95 since 2016, but the percentage of part-time students in the overall student population has dipped by little over 5%, from 62.9% in 2016 to 57.7% in 2018. For the most part, the trends observed for part-time students mirror those of the overall student population. And this can be said for the analysis by gender and first-generation status as well, which exhibited similar trends for part-time and full-time students. NSC has consistently tried to guide part-time students towards the accumulation of more credits. NSC has remained sensitive to the obligations these students must balance, but also recognizes the longer the degree pathway, the less likely it is that a student will complete. The figure in the upper left-hand corner shows the percentage of students who are enrolled in at least 15 credits, and as you can see, these numbers have generally increased for all students. Knowing that the commuter population won't always have the opportunity to go to the tutoring or writing centers, NSC made the decision to bring that support to the student in the classroom. The embedded peer support model has yielded tremendous results. NSC also addressed part-time student support through policy, such as mandatory advising for all incoming students. As you can see in the lower right-hand corner, the utilization of tutoring and advising by part-time students has steadily climbed since 2015. More work needs to be done, of course, but some of the efforts have started to pay dividends. As noted earlier, NSC has shifted more students to full-time since 2016, and the one-year retention of part-time students has exhibited modest increase since most of these initiatives were begun in 2013-14. As shown in the figure on the right. Finally, NSC recognizes that there is more that can be done to promote the success of part-time students. One proven strategy that will be part of NSC's CCA project that you heard about this morning is the six-year map of offered courses that provide a more predictable route to degree completion. The hope is to shift from a foggy one-lane road to a superhighway. An effort oriented around supporting part-time students before it's too late to help them is the proactive advising and revamped early alert system. NSC is also working on expanding the evening hours for academic advising and the advising center, and perhaps most importantly, will continue to examine other success initiatives as part of their ongoing strategic planning. With that, I would like to know if there are any questions.
Are there any questions? Yes, Regent Perkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was looking at the part-time non-returner survey. I really appreciate TMCC integrating that because that's a lot of valuable information about why students don't return. And it might, even though we might think it's one thing, when the students actually tell us, we can actually help them, you know, go to the completion. So I really appreciate that integration. Thank you.
Thank you for the question, comment. Any other? All right. Thank you for the presentation.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Yeah, she deserves an applause. And good job on the timing. We will move to item number 9. And I believe that will be Marcy Jackson.
Good morning. My name is Marcy Jackson, and I am the director of the System Sponsor Program and EBSCOR office. I'm here to tell you about our highlights from the 2017-2018 Sponsor Programs annual report. These are self-reported numbers from each of our institutions, and it's about all of the external funding that they have been able to receive through competitions that they have been involved in. We have funding that comes to us directly from the federal government. We have what's called federal pass-through, where another entity has received the funding first and has subawarded to one of our institutions, such as the state of Nevada. We've got state, local government, private, nonprofit, and private for-profit agencies that fund programs at our institutions that they would not be able to do if they didn't have this external funding. I'm not sure where my slides are. Great. We also categorize our funding that we receive from these sponsors with the national standards of research, instruction, student services, public service, scholarships and fellowships, and other. So these outside funding agencies actually allow us through these projects to help meet all of the strategic goals that NSHE has. Obviously, research is one of our major focuses for our three research institutions, but we also, through our public service programs, are able to provide preparatory services for low-income and first-generation students. We have tutoring and counseling that are part of student services, and our workforce goal through training programs for industry. If you're one of those people who loves to look at past reports, just so you know, we did change our baseline data in 2016. In the past, in this report, we included some of the Title IX financial aid funds, which are the Pell Grants, the Millennium Scholarships, that type of thing. Those are not really sponsor programs. Those are financial aid. So we removed them in 2016. So our baseline is 2016 at this point. You can see on this graph that we show that since that new baseline, we have increased our sponsor programs awards by 8%. The funding distribution on the left of the slide shows the amount of money each of our institutions brought in through their sponsored programs. And on the right side, we highlight the direct federal funding that has been received. For research, we had $86.3 million. other sponsor projects, $36.7 million. So we have $123 million that came in from directly from the federal government. So that's about 64% of that $224.2 million overall that we had has come to us directly from the feds. So each of the next slides shows you all of the numbers. It's the ups and the downs that we really expect to have with sponsor programs, because often you'll receive an award and it will be a three-year project, and you might get an incremental award where each year you get some funding, or you can receive all of your funding in year three or in year one, and so then in years two and three it doesn't show an increase of awards coming in, but that money is at the institution and it's being used. So we always expect some variability in our sponsor programs. But while you're looking at the numbers, I want to give you a little bit of background that each of the institutions wanted you to be aware of. So at UNLV, they did have an overall decrease in funding. However, they had an increase in their federal pass-through, and they also had an increase in the private nonprofit funding that they received for the year. The New School of Medicine also increased their funding by $2.8 million. At UNR, they had a huge increase of 14% in their awards.
Excuse me, one second. Yes. Sorry, Madam Chair. Yeah. Hiding over here in the corner. If you could just go back once. For the UNLV School of Medicine, that should be 4+%, right? Not 0.04%.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yes. Okay. Thanks.
So UNR had an increase in their overall awards, but also a 31% increase in their research awards. Some of their new research awards they wanted to highlight was funding from the National Institutes of Health for studies on hearing loss related to dementia and Alzheimer's, mm-hmm. the Department of Defense study on the effect of climate change and land use on the Desert Tortoise, and National Science Foundation funding on cyber defense. DRI did have a decrease of about 8%, but their research expenditures are holding stable due to those multi-year projects I talked about. They had a large increase in their success of proposals due to more collaboration among their faculty at the Institute, and stronger proposals that have actually been submitted to a wider range of sponsors. They increased their funding from the state of Nevada, private nonprofits, and private for-profits, which is part of their strategic plan to diversify their portfolio, which had really been federally based for years. At NSC, they received a new funding from the Department of Education for $2.7 million to increase the diversity of teachers and a new pipeline of teachers into our education system. They're planning their first summer institute for pre-education students this summer. They also received a Department of Education grant to allow some of their students to have childcare, 20 students actually, and they were able to leverage that in a partnership with the City of Henderson to expand to 40 students receiving childcare, helping them get to their classes. At CSN, the Governor's Office on Science, Innovation, and Technology for STEM Workforce Marketing Grant has allowed them to increase their dissemination of information about the programs that are available at CSN to try and increase the number of students that attend their STEM programs. CSN also is part of an NSF Lewis Stokes Alliance of Minority Participation, or LSAMP consortium, that's being led by UNLV. And CSN is concentrating on recruiting and retaining underrepresented minority students in STEM and having a transfer pathway to UNLV. So this is a great example of the interinstitutional collaborations that we have. At GBC, they received their first National Science Foundation Award this year, which is so awesome. They are working on a collaborative research with the University of Dayton and University of Colorado, and they're actually creating the instructional content component for that. They also received one of the STEM Challenge marketing grants, like CSN did, to promote their Operation Bravo internship program. And they received a $275,000 college readiness program for dual enrollment for the first time. At TMCC, they had an overall increase of awards of almost 32%. They received their latest update to the U.S. Department of Education Veterans Upward Bound program, which is now in its 29th year. It'll go through 2022 at this point and will reach 164 veterans. They also reached over 400 Gear Up students and their parents, trying to help them with their financial aid applications and financial literacy. At WNC, their big project, the Walker River Agricultural Economic Diversity Project, was just ending in 2018, and they had some economic benefits that they wanted to talk about there. The Sierra Nevada Lavender and Honey Festival, which is an agrotourism piece of that project, was attended by over 10,000 people. And the Desert Oasis Teff and Grain Project now has 6 to 10 regional farms involved every year with over $500,000 in sales. This slide shows the intra-institutional collaborations, which means one of our institutions received an award, and then they sub-awarded some of those funds to a different institution, and they were working collaboratively on a project. I want to thank Eagle Eyes Vice Chair Geddes for realizing we had an error on this slide. TMCC actually had one sub-award that to WNC. They did not sub-award money to themselves. This report was actually completed at the end of last fall, and of course it met the time period of July 1st, 2017 through June 2018. We started workday implementation in October of 2018. So information was pulled for two systems, and I want to thank the workday team of Linda Moore and Blair Horsey for creating brand new reports in Workday that pulled this information for us. And each of our institutions were our guinea pig testers to see, do the reports really work? Are we getting the information we need? And so this is one of those situations where there was something we didn't catch the first time around. But next year, we're excited that the process will probably go a little bit more smoothly. We had our institution submitted over 2,000 proposals last year, and we received over 1,000. Now, these are not necessarily, you can't look at them as in the same fiscal year, because we might submit a proposal in June of a year and not receive notice of funding until December of the next fiscal year. But this is just to show you the amount of work that our researchers and our faculty who do public service and student services are doing. And we have an overall $8 million increase from last year. We receive money from the state for matching funds. Some of our federal funders require that the state match the money that they are giving to us. And currently we match NSF EBSCOR, NASA EBSCOR, Department of Education, and NASA Space Grant. And then some of that funding supports the infrastructure of the EBSCOR sponsored programs office as well. The funding goes out to the institutions based on the projects that have been funded by the federal government. And they are generally sent out on a competition. Most of our match money is matching things like seed grants, travel grants, workshops, or our scholarships and fellowships. So the amount that goes to each institution will vary greatly year to year, just depending on where we are with the federal project and who had the most competitive applications that year for the scholarship or seed grants or whatnot. So that is the highlight of the sponsor programs for our institution. We brought in $224.2 million in external funding this year. Are there any questions for last year?
Are there any other questions? Thank you very much for the information.
Thank you.
For the record, Crystal Abba, Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs with the System Office. You have before you a handbook revision mandating academic advising and counseling. I will refer you to page 5 and go over the actual proposed language. You'll notice that we're deleting in section 22 of Title IV, Chapter 14, two subsections that have been there as long as I've been here or probably longer, and you notice the language is a bit antiquated as they use terms like should. So we deleted that. In lieu of that, we have a new subsection 1 and subsection 2. Subsection 1 basically states that effective fall of 2020, we will have mandatory advising for all first-time degree and certificate-seeking students, and it'll be required that continuing students also be periodically advised. Now, you'll notice there is obviously a fiscal impact to this. So this, the materials before you include not only the briefing paper, but a fiscal note that is intended to essentially delineate the institution's estimate for what the costs will be to add additional faculty necessary to meet this mandate. In addition, you can see from that table, which is on page 3 again, it gives you an idea there with the first three columns of what the current mandatory practices are. Many of our institutions currently do advise first-time students. However, the practice for advising continuing students is more sparse and, in this case, limited to Nevada State. Moving on to subsection 2 and back to page 5, you'll see that we have set a target for a student-to-advisor ratio of 350-1 that we are aiming that the institutions achieve by 2023. This is not a precedent in terms of putting a target of this nature into the board handbook. There have been cases in the past. The one that I recall most recently was almost a decade ago, where the board put into place a target for the institutions to hit in terms of the percent of the set aside for student access from the increases in the base registration fee. And actually that deadline, I believe it's 22-23. So again, we've put this specific target for the ratio and then a date to achieve that. So system admin would monitor that over time and, of course, report back to the board. Quick history, if I can go back. This, of course, came out of the Student Success Summit that was in January of 19 and then the March discussion. As I recall, it was Patrick Carter, Regent Carter, who specifically requested this, seeing a gap in some of the advising practices across the system. With that, I would beg the committee's recommendation for approval, and if you have any questions, I will defer to the institutions in terms of their practices.
I move for approval.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion second. Is there any discussion or questions? Yes, Regent Carter.
I'm in huge favor of doing this. My only concern is giving the specific number of 350-1. If everybody on the board is fine with that, then that, I guess I'm fine with that. But that seems like I don't know, maybe an arbitrary number. Maybe 500-1, you know.
For the record, Crystal, I don't know. It isn't. Good question. It's not an arbitrary number. NACADA actually doesn't make a formal recommendation, but this is the number that is typically referenced by national organizations. Is it aggressive? There is no doubt. Is it achievable? I'm going to put a little question mark by that because I don't know. That's why we're giving the institutions that time. As I indicated, we will regularly report back to the board in terms of their progress towards that. So it may be another case where as we get closer to that date, it may be necessary to. But if what happens if the institutions don't achieve that? Well, the reality it is nothing happens, but that goal is still there. And so the board is then sending a very clear message to the institutions that we want to make sure that advising departments are appropriately staffed. Because if you look at some of these numbers, it is a tad alarming when you see those ratios. These poor folks are, they're overloaded. And it's hard to give good information when you feel like, okay, I've got literally 700 students standing outside my door.
Are there any other comments or questions? All right, I would entertain a motion. Oh, I'm sorry. We did. I'm so sorry. Thank you. Then all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? I vote aye as well. The motion passes. And we will move to agenda item 12, and that's also Vice Chancellor Abba.
Thank you for the record. Crystal Abba, Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs. Before you, I have a handbook revision concerning credit by examination for the International Baccalaureate Diploma Program. If you'll see page 3, there's the actual handbook revision that I'll go through in a moment. And we normally don't include these, but we've had tremendous outreach, especially from Clark County. High schools in Clark County that have these programs that have expressed concern over the years that the institutions are not consistently articulating credit for courses taken through the IB program. So you'll notice there are a number of letters of support for this. This came from, and I believe it was the January special meeting, where the board approved an MOU between Clark County School District and ENCHI. Within that MOU, there was language about exploring the consistent articulation of IB credit. As a result, we bring this forward to you today, which revises Title IV, Chapter 14, Section 20. Specifically, Subsection 2 adds a provision that is very similar to Subsection 2B, that is very similar to Subsection 2A. So right now we have a policy on the books for AP. Students take an AP exam. And when we adopted this provision on AP several years ago, what we were aiming for was the consistent acceptance of those credits based on a test score. Because what was happening was some institutions would accept and articulate that credit at a score of 3, others 4, others 5. So this IB provision is modeled the same way, so that if a student receives a minimum score on the standard exam, depending on which exam they've taken, of a 4, 5, or 6, or a 5, 6, or 7, again, there's a higher level in standard exam, the institution would accept that credit. That credit may then be applied to satisfy a general elective, general education, or a degree requirement. Again, very consistent with the existing AB provision. This is a significant step forward. In my time in the system office, I will tell you that I've, over the years, it's at least once or twice a year that we get complaints in our office from students who have gone through an IB program and the institution either isn't accepting them or they're having difficulty getting there, or they realize, oh, one institution is and another is not. So again, a significant step in the right direction, and therefore I recommend the board's or the committee recommend approval, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Move to approve. Second.
All right. Is there any discussion, questions, comments? All right, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? I vote aye as well. The motion passes. Thank you, Vice Chancellor Abba.
And this last item is for Ms. Davis.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Renee Davis, Assistant Vice Chancellor, and she, Academic and Student Affairs. So I'm here today to talk about this revision to the handbook fee waiver for Nevada foster youth. And before I get into the details, with the committee's indulgence, I just wanted to provide a little second of extra information. I'm at the Cultural Diversity Committee. There is some discussion regarding the fee waiver and which students it would cover. And I believe the statement was made that it only applies to students who qualify for the Pell Grant. It's not correct. There is a requirement in the policy that the student file a FAFSA. That's the way that part of the requirement is written. So just a note. And let me just go ahead and address this revision. We have been working, our office and also the contacts on the various campuses with the Department of Health and Human Services. And they brought a population of students who was not being served by the waiver that they felt very important to address in board policy. So that's the revision we're bringing forward to you. There are certain circumstances where students who are in the custody of a Nevada agency may graduate from high school outside the state of Nevada. So a couple of the examples given in the italics text there in the policy revision, those two examples are there's an interstate compact where students may be placed out of state for treatment, and then, of course, therefore they would graduate from high school the state that they're residing in at the time. And then in certain other circumstances, students may be sent out of state to rejoin family members, and in those cases, if permanency is not achieved, then they still remain in the custody of the state of Nevada. So in both of those cases, it was We've had a few students who have contacted our campuses and weren't eligible under the current version of the policy. So the change that we're proposing is to add that language and also remove the requirement that the high school diploma be earned specifically in Nevada. The student still needs a diploma. It just does not have to come from a Nevada high school.
So moved. Second.
Okay, we have a motion and second. Is there any discussion, questions, comments? One moment, please. In the very last sentence, there's a comma that is out of place. If we could just make that friendly change to that, please.
By all means.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, ma'am.
If Council Reynolds wouldn't mind indicating on the record where he believes the comma should be placed.
This is Joe Reynolds for the record. I don't believe a comma is necessary at all.
Oh, it's removing the comma. Got it. We'll take the comma out.
After the age 18.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. So we have the motion and second. Any other questions or comments? All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? I vote aye as well. The motion passes. And thank you for that. All right. And we will move to agenda item number 14 for new business. And I just want to clarify that we have on new business for the next meeting, Regent Trachuk's questions in regard to the trending data with the report that we heard this morning. And I think I saw you make a note of that.
Yes, we'll provide that. We'll provide that under separate cover via the institution.
Great. Thank you. Is there? Yes, Regent Carter.
Sure. I would love for us to look at the pass rates for the condensed classes versus their traditional full-length classes. We see those mentioned as a benefit to student achievement. We just want to make sure that that is a benefit to student achievement.
Thank you for that point. Are there any other new business items? All right. We will move to public comment. And I see no public comment, so we will adjourn. Thank you very much.